From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. How long have you been here?
Just over 5 years. I got here on Mother's Day of 2012, so that was in May.
Okay, so 2012 to 2017. And where did you come from?
I was in Atlanta for almost the exact same amount of time. I was in Atlanta for 6 years.
That's me, of course, talking to Besha Rodel. Until recently, she had the enviable job of dining at the latest and greatest establishments in Los Angeles while getting paid to give her opinion as restaurant critic for the LA Weekly. Rodel's just left the job to return to Australia. Before she made the move, I asked her to speak with me about how the culinary landscape of LA changed while she was a critic. When you first arrived, what struck you about Los Angeles dining as different from Atlanta?
I mean, the main thing that struck me initially was just how overwhelming it was. It took me a year probably to even get my arms around it. I could have spent my entire 5 years here writing about like West Hollywood hotspots or on taquerias and what that was all about. And I think that unlike Atlanta, where the restaurant scene, in quotes, is very cut and dry. It's like, this is what it is. There are these kinds of restaurants, and then there are the smaller mom-and-pop restaurants, and that's what there is. You know, LA has just scenes upon scenes upon scenes.
And is part of that because of who we are as eaters, or is it who is writing about the food?
I think it's partially who's writing about the food. I think it's partially who is driving the eating economy here. That is something that I think is not talked about as much as it should be. I would guess that a huge number of dollars in the pool of eating out in Los Angeles are being spent by young Asian kids. And so, therefore, it makes what they're into really important. And the people whose money is being spent are much broader eaters, I think, than in a lot of other cities. They have broader tastes. They have more international tastes.
I'm going to quote you from one of your more recent reviews, your review of Botanica, a new restaurant in Silver Lake. It's a pretty recent review. Your first sentence is, "As someone who covers the tear-stained, blood-soaked money pit, that's the restaurant industry, I can say without hesitation that I want no part of this business except as an observer."
Yeah.
Has that feeling just intensified over the last 5 years that you've been here?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know why anybody does it these days. And like I said in that review, I'm intensely grateful that people continue to do it. And in the grand, silly argument about is food art or is it commerce, the argument for art is getting better and better because you would have to have that kind of artistic drive because the commerce part of it is pretty dismal as a, you know, exercise. You could do almost any other business and it might be less stressful and give you a more guaranteed living out of it.
So let's talk about Botanica and what it is, because to me it's sort of the nth degree example of what happens when you have an Instagram-driven point of view that is carried out throughout every single decision.
Right. These are women who came from media, and so they are very visual. They thought a lot in their media lives and in the restaurant life about what is this going to look like? Is it going to look like a beautiful spread in a beautiful magazine? And I say in that review, it's basically a lifestyle. It's this funny kind of meta loop that's happening. You walk into those places and you feel fabulous because you decided to walk in there and they're so beautiful and the whole feel of the place is so lovely. And then the food comes out and it looks like you can Instagram it beautifully and it looks like the type of thing that you want to think about yourself.
So it's incredibly aspirational.
Yes.
As opposed to deliciousness being the driving force.
Yeah. It's interesting because fancy restaurants used to be aspirational in a different way. It was like you aspired to be the type of person maybe who could afford to eat at a fancy restaurant or knew the wine list and weren't going to be embarrassed or whatever it was. It's an aspiration to be the kind of wonderful, beautiful person who would hang around at one of these places all afternoon and be like, oh, there's John Hamm, whatever. But it is catering to its neighborhood in that sense. I mean, that's kind of what Silver Lake has become. And a lot of the food there really is delicious. And like I said in that review, the thing that kind of makes me not just hate the place a lot is that those two women who own and run it really, really are excited and want you to love it and are incredibly welcoming. And it isn't kind of snooty and so hipsterish that, like, you feel like, you know, shabby for being there.
Yeah, aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
And then the review of Tao.
Uh-huh.
For people who don't live in Los Angeles, you have these two poles. You have the aspirational dining of Silver Lake, mm-hmm. what Silver Lake means. And then you have Hollywood.
And I usually ignore Hollywood. Jonathan Gold rarely reviews big Hollywood restaurants. I very rarely do. And it's funny because if you ask somebody who lived outside of L.A., what do they know about L.A.? That's probably what they would think it would be all about, the dining scene here. But like I said, you can live in a world where you don't even pay any attention to that. And usually I would not take on something like Tao because there's a lot of restaurants like that in Hollywood that are kind of for tourists and or celebrity, like that kind of, you know, Kardashian celebrity world. I think it's important every couple of years to step into that scene of Hollywood dining because it is a big part of this dining scene. But also, it had been a long time since I had eaten in a very expensive restaurant that was kind of geared towards oftentimes tourists or people who wanted that one lovely, fancy Hollywood night out. And I was really shocked at how terrible it was, not in a way that I expected it to be, but it felt jaded. It felt like they can get away with that because these people don't know any better. And that felt really icky to me. That's a national conversation in some ways because Tao is the highest grossing restaurant group in the country and has three of the highest grossing restaurants in the country. And so just to look at how do you do that and what are we spending our money on and what is luxury these days and who is it pointed at?
And why doesn't the quality of the food match the luxury of the surroundings?
Right.
When you have that, that's a completely different kind of 1% person.
It is. And it's interesting because I was talking to my husband about it when we were there because he used to work in a big, fancy Pan-Asian restaurant that was super hot spot. But the food where he worked was so much better. And I just feel like it's very difficult to serve that many meals. The place is ginormous. And so it's very difficult to serve that many meals and have the quality stay high. But there are things about Tao that are just, you could just buy the food straight from Cisco and warm it up and send it out, and it would be better than what some of their food is, you know?
Earlier this year, you wrote a response to food writer Bill Esparza's assertion that restaurant critics don't understand Mexican food because the industry is too white. Do you agree that food media is too white, and would you like to see someone of color replace you?
I would love that. And yes, I think food media is too white. There aren't very many people who are critics or are kind of interested in being critics or have the experience to be critics. It's a very narrow focus, and you need this very specific set of skills. And unfortunately, those skills are often made possible by growing up with a bunch of money so that you ate a lot around the world. That's not how I came at it. You know, I was a waitress, and that's how I got into this. So I really do think that it's a question of mentoring people early on. I feel like this is true in hiring across the board. People kind of want to fill positions with people of color, but they haven't done, the industry isn't doing the mentoring work early on. So then they're like, well, there's nobody to hire. Oh, well, guess we got to get this white guy, you know? And that is, you know, that's not just in the food and media industry. That's a problem for everything. But, you know, my response to Bill's piece really was that I want to listen to those chefs and those food writers who feel like they are not understood or are not heard or whatever that is, because I think that, you know, until media does better at having diversity of voices, those people are going to be right just in the sense that the voices that are out there judging them are too homogenous. And so there's not going to be another point of view.
There's also something interesting that you've touched on from time to time within the context of reviews. And that's the pull between best new anything stories and folks out there walking the walk who have been around for a while, who might be in the position of having to reinvent themselves or, you know, have focus be on them instead of the best new anything, just so we could see their evolution.
Right. Our hunger for the best, youngest, newest chef, I think, is really problematic. And it's part of the kind of rock star ification of the food world. You used to get respect as a chef for sticking around for a really long time, for having had a legacy. I don't want to go back to the, you know, bad old days where, like, it was just Daniel Boulud on the cover of every magazine forever. But at the same time, now it's just such this hungry cycle of who's the youngest, who's the best. And I don't think that it does the chefs that much good. I've come across a number of young chefs who I think kind of got swallowed up and chewed and spit out when they weren't ready for it. And who could resist that? I mean, it's all these accolades and it's all this attention and it feels like your career has been made. And then you talk to a lot of these folks a few years later and everyone's just moved on. So what does it mean if we're like, this is the best new chef, and then 2 years later you don't ever hear from that person again, or they're just kind of doing their thing but nobody's paying that much attention? I have always joked I want to have the workhorse award, where it's like the grumpy old dude who's just been doing it every day for 20 years and still gets out there and does it, because those are the chefs that in the past have really changed the way that we think about food or changed the way a city eats. And I despair a little bit at, like, who is that next generation going to be? Who's going to be the Nancy Silverton? Because everybody's just going to lose interest and be looking for the 12-year-old who can cook, you know?
Is there anything I haven't asked you that you would like to just sort of ruminate on or think about?
The biggest thing, and the thing I've been thinking about for the last couple of weeks a lot, is just how insanely, amazingly grateful I am to have had at this city for the years that I've had. I'm really sad about leaving it. And there just isn't anywhere as fascinating and as delicious and as confusing and wonderful in the country and maybe the world as LA. And I can't believe I was able to fall into being able to talk about it and talk about so many incredible people and chefs and all of that. And I'm feeling really kind of sad and emotional about that right now. Just walking away from that is really hard. So, yeah.
And you're going back to Melbourne.
I'm going home. Yes. First time in, it's almost 30 years. So.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you end up doing there.
Thanks.
And we hope you come back and visit.
I will. I'll be back.
Besha Rodel was LA Weekly's restaurant critic from 2012 to 2017. Find a link to her reviews and her final piece for the LA Weekly on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we find out what's in season at LA's farmers markets. That's when the show continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. It is official. Fall is upon us, and for many of us, that means apples. Let's find out which varieties Laura Avery's getting excited about at the market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting today with chef owner David Wilcox, who recently opened Journeyman in the former Canlay restaurant space in Atwater Village. And he's got an apple core in his hand, and I think he's out here doing some market research. So David, can you tell us a little bit about what you're shopping for today?
Sure thing. We have an apple tart seitan on the menu, and we were looking for a secondary apple to kind of counteract the tartness of the Belle de Biscoop apple that we were getting from Windrose. And we found these Freibergs from Sea Canyon, and just this banana flavor kind of sweetness and that like firm crunchiness of it would go really well in that tart seitan.
Let's talk about what a tart seitan is.
So it's basically like an easy description would be an inverted apple tart. So we cook the apples in big pieces, basically in quarters, in sugar and butter that's kind of made into a paste. And then that kind of melds together with the sugars and starches of the apple and creates a caramel. And then you put a pastry crust over the top. And we do actually a whole wheat pastry crust over that, so it has a little bit more depth of flavor. And then that gets baked in the oven to finish for, I don't know, about 20 minutes or so. And the crust gets nice and brown. And then we flip it back over so the caramel kind of just sits on top of that crust and you see those beautiful apples. And it's actually one of the first things you see when you walk in the door at Journeyman. We have a big pastry case right up front so you get tempted by all the desserts. And you see that apple tart seitan front and center.
So dessert first.
Yes.
Okay, and now the apples down at Sea Canyon and also at Windrose, you mentioned the Belle de Biscoop and then Sea Canyon. I'm amazed at how many apples there are that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
And Mike today at Sea Canyon, he's got his apples arranged. I counted 18 varieties.
Yeah.
And he goes from sweet to tart, left to right. Did you have to work your way all the way down the line and taste every one?
I kind of started in the middle. Like he was like, the Freibergs are like right on the like top end of the sweet. not like fully deep sweet. I started kind of there, and as soon as I tried that, I was like, that's the one. But I went through a few more of the other ones slightly to the left, you know, a little bit more tart, and then just came right back to it and was like, no, that's the one that has to be melded in there.
Had you never had one before?
Never had one, and I've had a lot of apples. I grew up in Michigan,
uh-huh.
and like apples were always our thing that ushered in fall, and so I've had a lot of really interesting apples over the years, but I've never seen a Freiburg before.
So you're kind of transitioned beyond peaches and now we're into apples?
Yeah, it was actually last week, I think it was, I had picked up the Bells and I was having just a rough week, you know, typical opening kind of a week where it was like there's a lot going on. I had cooks that were out sick. I had stuff with my teenage son at high school, and then also I'd gotten like a yellow jacket sting and I'm allergic to yellow jackets. And I was having one of those moments and I was just like feeling a little down and I was like, if I make tart tatin, I'll feel better. And I just put it on the menu that day, and that was it.
Aww.
And I felt much, much better, and everybody's really been enjoying it. So a lot of it for us with cooking, to me, is a very, I don't want to say it's an emotional experience, but it's a connection to the past for me. Mm-hmm. And so apples, to me, are very much a connection to home. My family's all in Michigan, so I can kind of connect to that fall transition that here we get, and we're definitely getting, but it doesn't feel quite the same when my sister's sending me pictures of the leaves changing. Mm-hmm. I can get a little bit of that connection through that.
Yeah. Okay, and then how long has Journeyman been open?
We've been open now about 6 weeks.
Okay.
You know, this place to us is very much about having a good time and rethinking a little bit the way that we're approaching dining.
Right, and you don't have tipping.
No, the tipping is all included in the price as well as the taxes. And the idea of that simply is just to really have a more equitable approach to the way we run our restaurant with our employees and train them all to do everything. So there are no distinctions between front of the house and back of the house here. There's no servers and cooks. Everybody's mm-hmm. doing everything. The cooks will run the food. The people that you would typically see that are bussing tables and stuff also help us with prep. And so everybody's learning how to do everything at this restaurant.
That was David Wilcox, and he is chef owner of Journeyman, who's taken over the recently vacated Canalay space, and he's creating, recreating, continuing the neighborhood tradition. I'm talking now with Mike Cerrone of Sea Canyon Farm. We usually catch up with Mike in the middle of June when his Blenheim apricots are in, and now it's full-on apple season. You had a very short sort of a peach crop, and now we're right into these apples. And I did count today, Mike, you've got 18 varieties.
Yep.
I went right for the Braeburn, which is right in the middle, and David yep. Wilcox went right for the Freiburg, so they're side by side.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about the Freiburg, which I had never heard of.
Okay, so Freiburg is a yellow apple, and most people associate that with a golden delicious, but these are way, way different. They're really rich. They have a deep flavor. They're super crunchy, too. Some people suggest that there's a little bit of a banana flavor, but there is definitely another flavor going on there. It's an odd variety. You really can't find it. I got it from this guy in Missouri, I'd say 15 years ago, and he had a nursery, and he was in some publication that I had been reading, and I got a whole bunch of different stuff from him, a lot of heirloom weird stuff. And it was kind of a gamble, but the variety really proved to do well in Sea Canyon. Typically, it ripens mid-October. This year, like everything else, it's way advanced. We're a month ahead. We had a super hot summer, which is unusual for us. We're a coastal canyon. So we started selling apples mid-August.
Which is early.
Which is way early. It's kind of scary early. But people were ready for them. It was interesting. So we're on it. We're selling them. I have some others that are similar to them, the Criterion. And the Criterion's a little bit more well-known, although it's not really grown commercially any longer. It's super fragile. It's a light yellow apple, but it's not a soft apple. Once again, this is a really crunchy yellow variety that's on the tart side. Really good flavor, deep, unusual flavor. And we dry farm those along with those Freibergs, and so they really come to their best in flavor when you do not irrigate them.
I really like that Braeburn, too, and that's kind of right in the middle of the sweet tart spectrum.
I love Braeburn. Mm-hmm. I think Braeburn's one of the best apples, period. Mm-hmm. I've never understood why, you know, it's kind of fallen out of favor commercially in New Zealand where it is grown or was grown extensively. They are removing Braeburn. Braeburn now is becoming an heirloom apple, an apple mm-hmm. of the past as New Zealand moves into new varieties such as the Jazz. And I think a lot of times these new varieties aren't really all that different. They have a new name, and that's a selling point.
Kind of a marketing thing.
Yeah, it's definitely marketing. Mm-hmm. And this is happening extensively. Washington's going to have a new variety out very shortly. Right now, it just has a number. But they say it's going to take the place of Fuji and it's going to completely revolutionize the current apple market. But we'll see. You know, sometimes they push apples before they're ready. And I think that's why we like to stick with some of our heirlooms and whatnot, because they're really good, you know, and I don't know why we have to move away from them.
That was Mike Cerrone. He's an apple farmer and peaches, and his, of course, his Blenheim apricots up in Sea Canyon, which is just south of San Luis Obispo, and he dry farms everything. He's in a natural canyon, and his apple varieties are so fun to look at and taste, and they will give you samples of whatever you'd like. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
They'll invite me over and I'll point out half a dozen things they can eat and they're like, really? I think they think because it's not tended or farmed that it's poisonous, and that's not always the case.
That's Mia Wasilovich. She's a forager who makes meals from the plants she finds growing in the wild. While Wasilovich documents her hunting and gathering on her blog, it's called Transitional Gastronomy, and in a new book called Ugly Little Greens. It's so funny. I think that here in LA, unless we're the children of parents who are recent immigrants or who have a tradition of gathering greens, we don't even understand that there are things to gather right in our immediate surroundings.
This is true. I mean, you walk by it in every pavement crack, you see edible weeds everywhere. You don't necessarily want to eat those, but most people who don't spray in their backyard or probably don't even tend to their backyard have an abundance of weeds.
So why don't you start with us here in Southern California? What are a couple of the greatest hits of weeds that we're likely to encounter?
I think in our little enclave in Los Angeles, the black mustard is just hands down something I look forward to because it's a hit of wasabi. What I love about this is you can slice it thin and use it as mustard, or you can grind the flowers into a mustard. It's just a very unique taste to our area, and it comes for a short period during the early summer. And it's just beautiful. You're driving on the freeway and you can just see the fields of yellow mustard, you know, everywhere. It's gorgeous. It reminds me of sea asparagus or sea beans. It has that salty, briny taste, and the stems are so juicy and succulent, and it's good for you. And I think it's so refreshing. I love it.
So let's start talking about how we can identify the plants and know that they're safe and edible.
You know, I always say, and I say this in the book as well, it's really important for you to do research online and in books. In my book, for example, or other people's book. But you really need that one-on-one connection with an actual person because it instills the confidence that you need to actually identify something. It's like an oral tradition that you pass from person to person, and that's so important. There are plants in every part of the world that have lookalikes, and it's for self-preservation for the plant, and those lookalikes can be very tricky. I remember I wouldn't eat chervil for the first 4 years I was foraging, just to be sure. It could be poison hemlock. To me, it doesn't look similar now at all. But when you first start out and the plants are both young and you compare them side by side, you can see how somebody can make that mistake. So stay away from anything in the carrot parsley family. If you're new to this, just don't do it.
You talk about a word called taxonomy,
which is the science of drilling down a method to identify plants. You know, I'm not a scientist, but it is interesting because if you do study which plant families are related and what are the subfamilies, you start to see patterns. I don't know every plant, but if I'm in an area I don't know, I can kind of make an educated guess about, oh, that must be in this family, the rose family, and maybe there's some stone fruit, wild stone fruit around, or, you know, I can make an educated guess based on that. So it is helpful.
If we take, let's say, the plants that you just mentioned, what are the kinds of flavors that we're mostly working with that we want to fold into our culinary process?
I think that depends on what time of year you pick them. We have several different seasons here. If we are fortunate to get rain, we'll have two springs, if you will. And then in the summer, when it's dry, you do get things that are spicier and pungent. When the weather is hot, I think they're just pulling everything from the soil. And sometimes you get things that are more bitter as the summer and the fall. So it depends on what season you pick them. But I think the flavors are quite distinct, like the nettles and the mustard. I think those are very flavor forward. And I would say a lot of what you see in the wild, you kind of see in the supermarket as well. They come from the brassica family. So we have a lot of things that have that broccoli, broccolini, cabbage-type flavor, too. So really hearty.
You say when you're foraging or harvesting wild ingredients, you say don't take the grandmother.
Yeah, don't take the biggest plant because she probably seeded everything around her, you know, is the little anchor for that community of plants. And it's the oldest one, so probably has the best survival genes to pass on when it seeds. As a general rule, I don't take the biggest one. And, you know, you don't want to harvest more than a small portion of the plant and move on. And if you see somebody else who's been there, an animal, move along.
So let's talk about cooking. Is there a dish that you find is sort of like a template that you return to over and over again, into which you can swap a certain number of these plants that you find?
I love cooking things in things. Kind of not exactly like a turducken, but I love cooking stews or soups or hearty meals like inside of a pumpkin or a gourd. And I find that those plants work particularly well. Cook it in the pumpkin, eat the pumpkin. It's just a really efficient way to eat it, and it's beautiful as well.
Also, when I think about like walking through local forests, I think about plants that have lots of seeds.
Yes, seeds are edible too, and they're wonderful. Pascal, who you know, he makes the most amazing condiment with a variety of seeds, nettle seeds, black sage seeds, feral mustard seeds.
I should say Pascal that we're referring to is Pascal Baudard. He's our noted local forager.
I use lamb's quarter seeds and nettle seeds kind of like you would quinoa. More so lamb's quarter seeds, they're sort of related to them and they cook the same way as long as you process them for bitterness. So you can use the seeds.
So you make these beautiful little cakes.
Yeah, you can use it as you would in a cereal, or I make these little timbal cake kind of things around the holidays, especially because that's harvesting them right after summer. Those are always a huge hit, and people can't believe that they're seeds from the weeds.
I noticed in the book, there's a beautiful image of pine tips in a liquid. I didn't know if it was water or vinegar, but how can we incorporate pine and acorns into dishes?
I love to pull it out into a sugar solution so that you can always have that for a sweet application. For savory applications, one of my favorite things I could drink it is to infuse the vinegars that you're going to use for salad or even a shrub even. A little bit goes a long way. You want to use the, you know, fresh tips, infuse it for a few weeks. Strain it and then refrigerate it. And acorns, it's like the hero of the foraging table. They're not only nutritious and in our area, extremely abundant. You do want to really, really make sure that if that's going to be something that you harvest, that you propagate it as well. One of the most simple things you can do is after they've been processed to remove the tannins in them, I just steep a big pot of cream. And the smell of it and the flavor that steeps out from the acorns is the most comforting thing ever. If I had to prescribe a sleepy time solution to somebody, it would be milk steeped with acorns.
When you say propagate them, do you mean just take a few of the acorns and stick them in the ground?
No, you can actually, there's a way to soak and sprout them. And you can find many resources online. But if you have property, I don't know why you wouldn't have an elderberry tree, for example, or an oak tree, a fruit-bearing oak tree. I don't know why you wouldn't have those in Southern California. You probably do.
Yeah, we don't think of it as fruit.
Right. Yeah, I think of it as stuff I have to sweep up.
Mia Wasilovich is author of Ugly Little Greens. Get her salted dandelion and plantain two ways. Recipe on the Good Food blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we find out where Jonathan Gold is dining this week. Don't go anywhere. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's time for our weekly restaurant review from LA Times critic Jonathan Gold. Where are we headed this week, Jonathan?
We're going to Rosaline.
Who's behind that?
Chef Ricardo Zarate, who we've seen a bunch of other places in Los Angeles before, notably Pica and Mochica, where we first discovered him.
He's had a whole sort of up and down experience, which happens if you're in this business long enough. But Rosaline seems like it's a pretty interesting landing on your feet kind of situation.
It's cheerful. It's a party place. In its use of tropical music and its loudness and the plants hanging down from everything, it reminds me a lot of Pan Latino tropical chic restaurants of the late 80s.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, kind of. The staff's super friendly, too. It's in the old Comsa space, right, in West Hollywood?
Right. And if you've been to Comsa, the old bistro, and you walked into this, you wouldn't recognize them as the same spaces at all. They've blown out the last half of the restaurant and made sort of a giant glassed-in patio. And the front of the restaurant is almost all bar.
Yeah. It's really, really active. Lots of energy. So, ceviches?
Well, of course there's ceviches. It's a Peruvian-style restaurant. And there's a separate ceviche menu. Mostly it serves as the bar menu, but it's also a ceviche menu for bites to eat with your drinks at the beginning. My favorite, weirdly enough, was a mushroom ceviche, which I don't think I'd ever seen before, which was like king mushrooms and portobellos and shimejis and some other things with some avocado in a ponzu-y sauce that had some burnt tomato in it.
I like it. You kind of see the Japanese technique that he grew up with when he was working in those kind of restaurants.
He worked in fusion restaurants for a giant period of his life, both in London and at a place on Abbot Kinney here.
And what about meat-driven Peruvian restaurants? Is there any such thing as big plates here?
Yeah, of course there are. There's only a few sharing plates. They tend to go around giant rice dishes. But I think the one that I like the best, I remember you loving too, was something called the wane. Wane is a giant tamale from the Peruvian jungle. It's a combo platter almost. There's a lot of stuff that's wrapped up in it. And it's called wane for a kind of interesting reason.
Why?
Because somebody decided that they looked like the severed head of John the Baptist.
I had no idea that was coming out of your mouth.
There are always wanes around the feast day of John the Baptist.
When that came to the table, I wanted to own it myself. I didn't want to share it with anybody.
I could see that. Their version of it has pork shank. It has a Swedish adobo-like sauce. There's garbanzos. There's, I guess, masa or tamale material. There's a hard-boiled egg and onions and nuts and things. And it's all wrapped in a banana leaf. There's another leaf that you'd probably use if you were in Peru, but as we're not so much in the steamable leaf business here in California, banana leaf works just fine.
Yeah, a super comforting dish with so many levels of flavor.
And it is shareable, but there's no reason why you couldn't have one all to yourself. They have other big rice dishes. There's an arroz con mariscos, which is sort of South American style or a Latino style paella, which is a little soupy with sea urchin and clams and scallops. And one that almost seems to be their signature there, which is the chaufa paella. Do you know that dish, chaufa?
I know I've had it, but I'm blanking. Describe it to me.
It's basically the Chinese Peruvian version of fried rice. Or chow fun, right?
Yeah.
He does it in a paella pan with pancetta, prawns, a shrimp paste to give it a little bit of funkiness, and a lot of Chinese sausage.
Sounds delicious.
It's like a umami combo platter with a lot of rice involved.
I like that, umami combo platter. What were some of your other sort of greatest hits of this meal?
In Pica, his last restaurant, he did a couple things that I wasn't super thrilled with. I mean, he did anticuchos of almost everything except the beef heart that they're made with in Peru. It's one of the miracles of street food in Lima is that this guy, you know, broiling over what looks like three tin cans stapled together is able to make beef heart taste as good as the best filet you've ever had. Here he does it with a beef heart. It's a really nice version of it, marinated with rocoto pepper, which is the hot pepper of Peru. There's a little bit of walnut in there. It's a really nice thing. The other thing that I didn't love so much at Pica was his insistence on making causa, which is a dish of mashed potatoes with stuff, into a sort of sushi. He put everything on causa. Here they serve causa as almost, it's a parfait.
It's a parfait, yeah.
It's served in a mason jar because everything has to be served in a mason jar. There was, you know, eggplant with a smoky taste. There was mashed potatoes that were whipped to a really light, fluffy consistency. There was mashed avocado, like guacamole. There was, I guess you'd call it aioli, but sort of a mayonnaise-y substance.
Really good. And what about the cocktail program or dessert?
There's a big, complicated cocktail program, but I think all that you have to remember is that the pisco sour, the traditional Peruvian cocktails, is done as well here as it is anywhere. Really delicious.
Well, thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Rosaline in West Hollywood. Text the words good food to 69866, and you will get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations.
TV was my, for better or worse, my companion, my friend. I sat there with usually boxed macaroni and cheese and maybe a fried pork chop or, you know, sometimes Thai food. I don't even remember at this point what I would watch, but I just remember that I needed some sort of other stimuli because I didn't have a dining companion.
That's Chef Chris Yembamroong. Maybe he was eating TV dinners alone back in the day, but now he's running the extremely popular Thai restaurants Night Market and Night Market Song. Yembamroong also just published a cookbook. It's named after the restaurant. So while you were growing up, your parents were kind of busy at night.
My parents opened up a restaurant called Talisai the year I was born, 1982. So I was born into a restaurant family. Basically, all your hours that you're not in school, if you're a kid, are spent at the restaurant doing something. For me, it started as sitting in the office and drawing. I used to want to be an architect. I would design hotels and chairs and stuff like that. And then later on, I started venturing into the kitchen because I got bored with the drawing.
So what led you to enter the kitchen? Because you made the decision kind of relatively late, I would say.
I literally entered the kitchen, actually a lot earlier. I mean, when I was in elementary school, it was through eating. So I had a couple things that I liked to eat. I would request my after-school meal, like my family's restaurants on Sunset, and I would be starving, and I'd request like a bowl of chicken lap or something like that and a wad of sticky rice. And this is when I was 9 or so. I started eating it so much and realized that it wasn't being made to my liking. And so I think that's when I first actually went in the kitchen and said, okay, I want it a little saltier. I want it like this way or that way. And I don't want you to put chili jam in it.
Talk to me about your grandmother.
You know, I say that she's my true north. And not even just in terms of cooking. Cooking is sort of the least of it. Just in terms of her spirit, you know, she was like a very young mother. She had my father, who's the oldest of 7 kids, when she was under 18. And she's always sort of hustled. She's always done whatever it took to, you know, take care of her family and all that. She used to hustle diamonds. This is back in the day when there was basically no economy in Thailand. And she would just get diamonds from the city and then sew them into, like, the hem of her pants and shuttle them out to the Northeast and sell the diamonds out there. And then she'd bring silk from the Northeast and sell it in the city. And she'd do that whole routine just, like, over and over. She would do the sewing thing because there were all these bandits on the road, and that was the only way that she could keep them from being stolen. But, you know, that sort of stuff, I think, influences me more than anything. She was the first person I really saw cooking. Sometimes, you know, she'll make a really antiquated, super old world kind of feeling food, you know, and she made this dish for me last night that was like that.
When you talk about that antiquated old world, what is it? Is it stripped down? Is the flavor less sweet or more forward? What makes it that way?
It's funny, this dish that she made me last night, it's called khonomjin namprik. Khonomjin is the white fermented rice noodle that's eaten with curry on top. It's essentially like a curry, but with peanuts pulverized into it. I don't know how to describe it. It's a sensibility that tastes old, for lack of a better word. Like it's something that's maybe not appreciated anymore. It's not the thing that, you know, today people like, which is seems to be everything like dialed to 11. It's sort of the opposite of that.
Let's talk about that everything dialed to 11. I feel like when you first opened Night Market on Sunset, the flavors were, to put it mildly, bold, like insane, almost like art project level flavor. Where did that level of dialing it up come to for you? And do you still cook that way?
Well, I'll start with the easier part of the answer, which is no, I don't cook that way anymore. In terms of where it came from before, this dialing everything up to 11 is, I just come off the biggest failure, and I was like 25 at the time, it was the biggest face plant that I had ever taken, and that was taking over my family's restaurant after moving back from New York and looking to do, at the same time, you know, something new and preserving something that had existed for 25 years. That didn't go well, and it was a couple years of extreme pain and failure and humiliation and that sort of stuff. So when I started Night Market, I kind of saw it as it couldn't get any lower than that. It couldn't get any worse. Now that I'm thinking back on it, it must have been kind of a reaction, or like I wanted to do all these things. They didn't work so well, so I had to dial everything back to the sort of middle of the road just to stay afloat and get my people paid. And then when I had this this opportunity to do the thing right next door to my family's restaurant, which was like a big reminder of that failure. You know, in Thailand, you actually, it's something that you talk about, or at least cooks talk about. It's like the mark of an inexperienced cook is like to have a heavy hand, you know, and there's actually a phrase for that in Thai that describes that. And that's definitely what I had at the time, a super heavy hand. I thought it was the only way to do it. And I've since dialed it way back.
It's interesting to me because Andy Ricker, another Thai chef restaurateur, he describes your food as not only Thai, but LA food. And I think that first iteration of your food created an appreciation for boldness that subsequent people have really capitalized on.
What he said about it being LA food is one of the biggest compliments that I can get. We talk about this constantly with the team. You know, we really look at Night Market as an LA restaurant and not just a Thai place or a Northern Thai place. You know, it's an LA place and it's LA food. I think that a lot of stuff I did early on was necessary in a way for my process or my journey. I couldn't be where I am now if I didn't go through all those things. I didn't think there was a place that served that feeling or that sensibility with the food and, you know, like natural wine and stuff in that atmosphere. I didn't think that existed. Probably now it exists in a couple of different places, but at the time, I don't think it did.
Let's talk about that wine. You have a fantasy about having somebody come to the restaurant and just order wine without eating. Where did you get this really intense love for wine? And why do you think wine and Thai food make so much sense?
Wine had always been around, you know, like growing up in a restaurant family, and so I always drank wine. In terms of why it works with Thai food, you know, when you think of Thai food, you usually think of like a cold, watery beer to sort of quench your thirst and tame the heat a little bit and that kind of thing. A lot of the wines at the restaurant kind of function along those lines as beverages that are really thirst-quenching, you know, simple, very simple drinks. And it's not a way of saying this is better than beer, you know, because it's not. It's a way of saying, hey, why not try something else that could be a lot of fun?
Do you have a signature dish?
I think our signature dish would be our crispy rice salad. It's something that exists in Thailand in this really rustic preparation where it's more about like the fermented pork with a little bit of rice on it, and the vegetable part is sometimes served on top, and it's super delicious and it's super great. But along the lines of, you know, talking about Night Market as more of like an LA place, I really saw the potential for that salad as being like an LA salad, something that was really poppy and accessible and really fun to eat and bold and all those sorts of things, and less rustic and less weird, for lack of a better word.
And really addictive.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I really want for Night Market to be a place that people can go to, you know, on a Tuesday night or on a Friday or Saturday night to celebrate or whatever. And, you know, I think part of that is the addictive quality.
So I understand you're opening a third restaurant in Venice.
I am, yeah.
When's that going to open?
Everybody wants to know when it's going to open.
You don't have to tell me.
I get messages every day about this and I never answer them, but it's opening soon this year. I'll probably go over there right after this and check it out. And what I'll say is that last year, whenever it was that that we announced it, it was when I got the Food and Wine Best New Chef thing. It was like we had an opportunity to kind of announce it in the magazine. And I thought, oh, that's so great. Like the gravity of it, you know, like it would be the perfect thing to talk about in the magazine, even though we're not really ready to announce it. And I think that excitement sort of got the better of me where I wanted to just put it out there, and it was too soon. The deal wasn't wrapped up yet and we ended up being delayed anyways, but we're probably more like delayed like 6 months and not like a year plus. So,
well, thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Find a recipe from Chris's Penang beef curry on the Good Food blog. It's his grandmother's recipe and is included in his new Night Market cookbook. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. We close out this week's show eating Korean-Mexican food in Korea. That's when the show continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Korean-Mexican fusion food, it's a Los Angeles idea. Think carnitas French fries with kimchi or sweet and salty pork tacos. You can find all that at a food truck in L.A. And now you can also get it in South Korea. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb traveled to Seoul to give it a try.
When you move your family abroad, you bring your culture with you, your language, your religion, and maybe most importantly for some, your food. That's been true for years for the roughly 300,000 Korean immigrants to Southern California. And now there's a growing number of young entrepreneurs that are moving back to Seoul, and they're bringing with them a food culture that's simmered in LA's melting pot.
The entire concept is based off of our experience. It's based off of how we were raised, where we grew up.
That's Chuan Kim. He recently moved back to South Korea after growing up in Texas. His business partner, Kenneth Park, grew up in L.A., and together, they run a Korean-Mexican food restaurant in Seoul's trendy Itaewon district. It's called Vato's Urban Tacos, and Kim says they learned to cook this style of food out of necessity.
Our parents are both immigrant families. They're out working, and we stayed at home with our siblings a lot, and we kind of had to prepare our own food.
And that meant a lot of leftovers from the fridge.
And it's usually some sort of a protein or, you know, a bulgogi or a galbi or a buldak or barbecue meats, right?
My house, so there's always tortillas and cheese, like for quesadillas, for snacks and things like that.
That combination, Kim says, defines the Kyopo experience, which is Korean for expat.
We had the Korean food influence from our home through our parents. And then when we're out in a social setting in the United States, in Texas and California, we got the Mexican influence because it's such a go-to food for everybody. It's a comfort food.
It's a style of cooking made popular by LA chef Roy Choi, a South Korean who grew up in Southern California. Choi made a name for himself with hybrid Korean-Mexican food, like tacos with Korean barbecued meats and salsa, which he sells from his Kogi truck, now a staple in the city's food truck scene.
Basically, we looked at the example of Kogi truck, and we said, wow, this truck, food truck and the food genre that this guy created has a humongous following, and it's based off of Korean food. And we said, why wouldn't this work in Korea?
But when you visit Seoul, there isn't a food truck scene at all. I spent days trying to find just one. Instead, the Korean-Mexican food restaurants here are strictly brick and mortar. Inside the restaurant, it's time to sample some of the dishes.
If you stab it from the top to bottom, you get every single ingredient in one bite.
So these fries are carnitas, kimchi, and then I'm also seeing a little cream sauce and some red onion.
Hot sauce.
Oh yeah, so that initial taste, you get the kimchi immediately.
It's that pungent, fermented, and salty cabbage taste that conceptually doesn't belong anywhere near Mexican food. There's also galbi. It's a Korean short rib dish, mainly beef, marinated with a little sugar and ginger. Here, it's served on a taco with an Asian-inspired slaw, some cilantro, and a samjang aioli.
And samjang is the bean paste and red pepper paste mix that you use on all Korean barbecue wraps.
It's salty, spicy, savory. For me, it's a combination of flavors I know pretty well from eating in L.A., where fusion cuisine has been popular for decades. Here in South Korea, there's Italian food, Mexican food, even barbecue. But Korean-Mexican fusion, does that work here? I thought I'd ask someone who knows a lot about Mexican food.
Claro. My name is Bruno Figueroa, and I'm the Mexican ambassador in Korea.
Now, Figueroa admits he's a fan of the authentic, but he says it's important to embrace the blending of cultures. In this moment of globalization, he says, we have to be open to when these mixtures occur, and Vato's Urban Tacos seems, to him, to be an extraordinary combination of the United States, Mexico, and Korea. So the Mexican ambassador gives his stamp of approval. What about the South Korean customers? Poor young Lee is sitting across from a friend, table full of food at the restaurant, now packed on a weeknight.
아, 한국 맛이랑 멕시코 맛 같이 합쳐져서 융합돼서 좋은 것 같아요.
Oh, they liked it because it had both Korean and Mexican flavor.
For Kang Yu-sig,
김치 케사디아가 맛있어 좋았어요.
They like kimchi quesadilla. It's tasty.
Vato's Urban Tacos isn't the only restaurant that's brought this marriage of Korean-Mexican flavors back to South Korea. There are several others, Koreanos, Muchacho Seoul, Gangnam Taco, and they all have roots in the food traditions of contemporary L.A. or the Southwest. And it's not just tacos, burritos, and quesadillas. One of Kim's favorite items on the menu, he says, is their honey tequila chicken wings.
So you dip the wings in the blue cheese, and then you dip the jalapeno. And then you eat it in one bite. One of my favorite dishes here. It goes great with beer.
The two chuckle when I ask them about the biggest challenge they faced in rolling out their restaurants. It all centers around an herb that's ubiquitous in Mexican cooking.
People said, hey, you can't make it with Mexican cuisine because it's cilantro. Korean people just don't like it.
Cilantro. For many Koreans, it tastes like soap.
So we consciously decided that time, we said, you know what, put it on everything.
At first, Park said they'd offer up full refunds to people who tried their spicy chicken tacos, which comes from an old Korean pundak recipe, their staple kimchi fries, anything that had cilantro on it, if customers didn't like it. And after a while, people just stopped asking for dishes without cilantro. It can also be hard to find the right ingredients.
When we started the restaurant, there was no masa in Korea.
Masa is corn flour, and if you've had street tacos in Mexico or after a late night in Southern California, you're familiar with that thick, almost granular texture.
We literally had to bring it in by the suitcases, and that's how our hybrid tortilla was born.
At Vato's, they're serving up tortillas made with corn and wheat flour. It's a hybrid that tastes more like a dumpling wrap. Park says it's a familiar vehicle for South Koreans that are unfamiliar with Mexican food. Even with the Mexican influence, Kim says that South Koreans are still able to recognize the food in their restaurants, and that's been a benefit for their business.
The way that people enjoy their food, the two cultures enjoy their food, I think is very similar.
And Park agrees.
Good food is good food. You know, you open a little Moroccan restaurant and it tastes good, people are going to have their first taste of Moroccan culture through that dish that they're eating at that little tiny restaurant in Seoul. And that's kind of what we're trying to do with, you know, Vato's and Mexican cuisine.
As this food culture ping-pongs between Seoul and the U.S., keep an eye out for those dumpling-wrapped tortillas back in L.A. Who knows? You might just find them at your favorite food truck. Reporting from Seoul, South Korea, for Good Food, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
Gustavo Arellano is editor of the OC Weekly and host of KCRW's Orange County Line. So, Gustavo, this week you're taking us to a place that is very well beloved.
This is the most popular taco in Southern California over the past couple of years, a taco that is a burrito, Burritos La Palma.
So why are we talking to you about Burritos La Palma? I think I've already talked about it with Jonathan.
Oh, Jonathan loves the place, but Jonathan's been to their truck and to the one in South El Monte. I'm talking about where it should belong, the one that really matters, which is the one in Santana.
Okay, so it all starts with the tortilla, right?
Oh, my God. So if I want to criticize Southern California Mexican food for one thing, I will say for the lack of good flour tortillas. We don't know how to make flour tortillas. Burritos La Palma, the owner, Alberto Bañuelos, he makes one of the best flour tortillas I've ever had. It's one of those that you could see right through it because it's so thin, you could wrap it up into a burrito and it maintains its consistency. It's really... It's chewy. It's absolutely delicious the way it is.
And we should say these burritos are not burritos that are laden with beans and rice.
So this is not your Calmex burrito. This is not your mission style burrito. Frankly, you have to eat three of them just to get full. They're small, little, thin burritos, just how they eat them actually in Mexico, traditionally, the small ones. But the best part about these burritos is you could have a tinga one, so it's going to be chicken, or you could have a really good one, a chicharron, not pork rinds, but a chicharron basically made into a stew. But my favorite dish, and you know, is the birria de res. So this is going to be birria. Most people think of it as goat, but it's a beef stew. And Until they started making birria de res, no restaurant in Southern California served birria de res. It's a specialty of where both Albert and myself are from, Jerez, Zacatecas. The only place you're able to get birria de res would be at a wedding in Montebello or a quinceañera in Anaheim.
So when people go to this place, do they just order a dozen at a time?
You should. Take a bunch for home. What I like to do is mix and match. So the simple bean and cheese is perfect. Get that one. Get a birria de res one. Get a chicken tinga one. They also have a really good torta, which is just lobo. So it's going to be like, what's lobo? Pernil. So pork leg. It's a roasted pork leg, which they put with ham. And they have this interesting watery salsa. Now, I usually don't care for watery salsa, but what you do is you get the little canister and just dip it. And it's not going to be spicy at all. For the spice, you're going to get the serranos. Just eat them the mordida. You know, just bite by bite. But this little salsa, it's almost like it refreshes the palate every time you eat it. So every time you're eating a little bit here, a little bit there, absolutely delicious.
I had no idea they did bean and cheese burritos.
Oh, yeah. They're not the bean and cheese burritos of Allen B. So not the Chicano bean and cheese, but it's just nice and simple. And the great thing with Burritos La Palma, they're only going to get better. So if you want to buy their tortillas, you could absolutely buy their tortillas. They have them for sale. They're planning to open their own little tortilla factory there. And as they start selling more and more tortillas, they want to get more dishes from Jerez. And I wrote an article for the LA Times years ago about how there's so many people from Zacatecas in Southern California, but you never see our cuisine here. So this is the place. If you want to know, let's put it this way. If you want to know how Gustavo has been eating his entire life at home with his mommy, you have to go to Burritos La Palma.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
That was Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly, host of KCRW's Orange County Line, and author of Taco USA. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can also listen to our show on the website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team, the awesome Laro Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Michelle Escobar, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.